Ladies and gentlemen, we'll start in about 1 minute. If you would find your seats, please. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the president, Gilder Publishing, Mary Collins.
Welcome to the 10th annual Gilder Forbes Telecosm Conference. I'm the one responsible for packing 60 speakers into the next 2 days, And I'm also the one responsible for making sure there's an open bar set up at 5 every night. So if your head is spinning on Friday afternoon and you're suffering from a telecosmic hangover, you can just go ahead and blame me. But I do have to say, this isn't only the 10th annual telecosm. It's not the 10th telecosm ever. It's the best telecosm ever. And a big reason for that, actually the biggest reason for that, is our first speaker. And even though I've had the pleasure of working for George for the last 6.5, 7 years, I've actually never introduced him at one of our events. So I just wanted to take a minute and tell you all something you probably don't know about George. George isn't very good at seeing some things. He's not good at seeing things like a spot on a shirt, an untied shoelace, what day of the week it is on his calendar, where he parked his car in the airport parking garage, a deer in the road, a mountain lion on the side of his running path, another deer in the road, but you get the point. But George is incredibly good at seeing one thing, and it's the reason we're all here. He can see the future. And we're not talking tomorrow or next Tuesday or who's coming to Christmas dinner. We're talking about years, decades even. I mean, this guy wrote the first edition of Life After Television in, what, 1990? And even though it wasn't on my elementary school's recommended reading list, I did eventually get around to reading it. And I think just about every word he's ever written since then. And I have to say that his instincts and his ideas continue to surprise me, and his optimism continues to inspire me. And I think the same is probably true for many of you in this room. So please join me in welcoming our first speaker, George Gilder.
Thank you, Mary. I'm speechless, but I guess I'll have to recover from that serious condition inflicted by Mary, who makes all this stuff work and has for the last 6 years or whenever it is. She's been pretty much handling these conferences. But Wired Magazine says we're tired at 10. And this was several months ago. And the Wired people were Al Gore and a whole bunch of other interesting technology prophets. But they said we're over the hill at 10. Just to test out whether I was over the hill anyway, I've run up the mountain behind us twice so far during my time here, and I hope to do it 3 or 4 more times over the hill. But anyway, this is the Imperial Telecosm at 10, and there's some people who are who've actually been to all 10 telecosms. And I think we should, the one I know is Ashby Foote. And Ashby doesn't look slightly tired. Are you tired, Ashby?
When do we run tomorrow?
And Nick Tredenick really gave me the motif for the Imperial Telecosm when he said that these microchip and telecosmic technologies are the only technologies that invade all neighboring realms and capture and transform, conquer, and reconfigure them. And this is just now happening after all these years to television, as the telecosm is finally overthrowing television. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, these telephone companies don't want to divulge it. They're kind of embarrassed. But what they're really doing is killing TV. And unless Verizon and AT&T and these companies that are launching these new technologies in the local loop understand that they're killing TV, if they try to imitate TV, they're goners. But if they really kill TV and transform our information environment, they can triumph and succeed. And I think Verizon, who's our leading sponsor this telecosm, the 10th telecosm, is doing a bold fiber to the home program that actually does consummate the telecosm as it, at least in the local loop, to the extent that we can really have fiber with its virtually infinite capabilities deployed to millions of homes across the country. The possibility of destroying television in its lowest common denominator scheduled regime becomes more and more feasible. But the telecosm also invaded the camera business, the camera and imaging business. And we all know that the Foveon imager has been one of the paradigmatic telecosm companies almost from the beginning. And Carver Mead is really the founder of this conference and has been to all of them. And he is, the Foveon imager has had its setbacks and obstacles and problems over the years. But this year, it's now breaking out all over at Photokina and everywhere else with a really beautiful, elegant camera that can actually make this project a triumphant item for Telecosm 10. And then the telecosm in this conference is invading healthcare, and we've got a bunch of speeches on healthcare. Andy Kessler's book is in front of all your tables. Andy Kessler's book is just a superb, lively, fun description of how medicine will be transformed. And Andy's been to almost all the telecosms, and his book, I think, is something of a bestseller. And then Art Robinson, who's been doing profound work in this field for decades in transformation of healthcare, is also speaking. And between the two of them, you should leave this conference with a new vision of how the telecosm will change medicine and healthcare and longevity in all our lives, which, you know, the span of life and the speed of light are the two constraints. And this span of life problem becomes increasingly prominent in the lives of some of our telecosm participants. And then Rich Karlgaard is doing a panel on how the telecosm is transforming aviation. And my son Richard, who's entering that business, is going to be very interested in that. But Rich has got a whole set of new telecosmic technologies transforming aviation. And education is also going to fall before this onslaught. Mike Milken is chairman of Knowledge Universe and has spoke at the first telecosm way back in Palm Beach 10 years ago. And he will address a wide range of subjects in his visionary way, but certainly the transformation of education and medical care are two of his chief preoccupations. And finally, and perhaps most important, at least in our current predicament as a nation, the telecosm and the microcosm are transforming defense. And we've had Terry Turpin for years at Essex describing these technologies. And as Essex Corporation has grown massively during this time under his technical leadership. But the first figure in the telecosm, from my point of view, the first person who really gave me the telecosmic vision was Peter Huber. And Peter Huber wrote a book decades ago, which he published himself, and it sold some 600,000 copies, or I can't remember, maybe it was $600,000 or so. It was an amazing book on telecommunications. And it pointed out that the microchip and the laser, both of which originating at Bell Labs, would bring down the empires of telephony. And this is what really led me to see that the microchip, which I'd been writing about for some time at that point, was ultimately a weapon of communications, and it would transform all the communications empires, including most dramatically television and telephony. But Peter, as many of you know, is after that book on launching the telecosm, I've forgotten its title, he could probably tell me. He may not remember. He's written so many books and had so many ideas over the years that he's really, but his most recent book is The Bottomless Well, which shows the essential infinitude of energy possibilities. And energy resources are essentially infinite. What is scarce is the political will to allow their exploitation. And before that, he wrote a book called Hard Green, which is the best single book ever written about environmentalism, and explains how the bicycle is a more menacing threat to the environment than the SUV. He'll have to explain that if he wants to. Orwell's Revenge, which is an early book, which showed how the technologies of the microcosm would be liberating rather than confining, that the telescreen would be a source of communication rather than a source of Big Brother's control. And that really was the first Life After Television book. But the best speech I've ever heard Peter, or virtually anybody else, give was his response to the September 11th catastrophe, which canceled telecosm that year. We had a small plenary session with Carver and Nick Trudenik and a few others at what was then called Bullwackers, is now Sandy's Pub. I presume it's named after Sandy Fleischman. Any case, Sandy is, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's named after Sandy. Peter, and we had to have our conference a month later at the Fairmont in San Francisco, and Peter gave the most moving and powerful speech about the importance of technology to defense and how our technology would be absolutely critical to the success of our struggle against terrorism. And it was an awesome speech, which I recommend all of you to read if you can. And we're very fortunate to have Peter back tonight. So, Peter Huber.
Some factories use a very high-intensity radioactive source to harden rubber. You zap the stuff and it breaks the links in the polymer and cross-links it, and you make hard rubber out of soft. And one such factory was situated in the area of what used to be the Soviet Union. A civil war broke out in that area, and the factory was abandoned and forgotten. Sometime later, it dawned on the now Russian authorities that they had never recovered this nuclear material. They were no longer in control of that part of their country. They dispatched helicopters and soldiers. There was some very violent confrontation, which some of you would have seen on television without knowing exactly why it was happening. The soldiers took over the factory again, made their way to this large vulcanizing unit, but the source was no longer in it. The source was quite hot enough to kill you if you carried it for any length of time. And as I heard the story, I was traveling in Eastern Europe a few years ago, and I heard this directly from someone who spoke and was in a position to speak with firsthand knowledge and real authority. As the story unraveled, as he told it, the group that had taken it was very hostile to the Russian authorities and had found out quite quickly that this source was there and that it was very powerful and it was killing them. And they resolved to form a human chain and carry it 20 or 30 kilometers each. And they were headed for the Moscow subway and were intercepted some 20 kilometers from the city. When a deliberate release occurs in the United States, as I think it inevitably will, a deliberate nuclear release, we will almost certainly find that the material originated somewhere equally mundane, a hospital, a factory, an industrial setting. There's a whole lot of nuclear material out there all over the place. It has many very useful applications, and people who want to look for it will find it. The London subway bombers used triacetone triperoxide. They brewed it in a bathtub using acetone, drain cleaner, and bleach. The Japanese subway attackers home-brewed their sarin gas. The Oklahoma bombers mixed, of course, fertilizer and diesel fuel. It is easy to forget about things like this. They're not pleasant, and if they don't happen sort of in the recent memory, one would prefer to think they're not possible. The simple fact is, and people in the know really do know this, we face today, still face today, an absolutely horrifying disconnect between new weapons, these very toxic materials, and our own ability to see them before they are released or detonated in a subway or a stadium. Scientists can, of course, see anything in a lab. They can see a single atom of cobalt-60 or a molecule of TATP or a strand of anthrax DNA. Just bring your sample to the right building and a well-trained technician will fire up a mainframe unit, a room-sized unit, something even larger than that, and in due course the instrument will tell you exactly what it is that you brought in. It happens after every attack, and they get it right. They can always tell you what hit you after. But after is not when you want to know. The challenge is to see these things before they detonate, before they're dispersed, before they get into the air ducts, and not just sort of see them roughly or approximately, but see them so precisely that you can say exactly what they are and react to them in real time in all the places where you have to do this. How do you even begin to do that? In transit, somewhere or other across just Manhattan, to pick a city at random, on any given day are some 4 million letters, 3 million people, at least 500,000 motor vehicles, 500,000 parcels, any of which can be carrying something about this big that can cause just enormous harm. Some time ago, the officers that patrol the mall in Washington, D.C. were given radiation detectors, belt-sized units. They soon took the batteries out and turned them off. The units beeped so many false alarms, they were worse than useless. Radiation is easy to detect. It's easy to detect badly. But you can't evacuate Yankee Stadium twice during every game to respond to false alarms. Inferior technologies, again, are worse than useless. And a significant fraction of the money spent in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 on technology was wasted. And yet with that said, there is absolutely no other alternative. You cannot fight unstable atomic nuclei or nerve agents or DNA with guns and guards and gates. Guns and guards and gates are too expensive and completely ineffectual. They can't see the stuff. If they can see it, they can't intercept it. They can't stop it. You need the accuracy of a lab, but you need it not in a lab. You need it in a pager. You need it in something much smaller. You need to push out the boundaries so you can screen huge numbers of packages and containers and so on far out at points of origin in Singapore and in China and overseas, and you need to screen again at ports of entry and at key switching points and mail centers and transportation transit points and buildings and hospitals where the first responders, you know, in Japan after the sarin gas was released, several of the victims, of course, were the first responders in the hospitals who were exposed to the gas as they tried to save the people exposed. And on and on and on, down, this massively structured, tiered, continuous defense in depth against these things that you can find in any rubber factory. This is not as small as it should be, radiation detector. It is actually used, this one, and they keep the batteries in it. The Department of Energy's nuclear emergency search team uses it. These are the guys they dispatch in helicopters and Learjets and so on if they think somebody's left a box of really bad stuff somewhere. The Coast Guard uses it, the New York Police Department uses it, and many others. Most of its functionality is in this one, which is half the size, came out a couple of years later. These units don't just tell you that this gentleman here in the front row is hot. They tell you exactly what's making him hot. They will actually tell you if he's hot because he's packing iodine-131, in which case you probably can sit tight. He probably went through a diagnostic medical procedure yesterday or the day before. Or they will tell you if he's hot because he's got cobalt-60 on him, in which case you should definitely follow me to the exit. You should never, ever, ever see cobalt-60. That unit, by the way, can see it at a kilometer, 1 gram of it. Cobalt-60 is very bad stuff. What are the essential technologies that make a unit like this possible and countless others like it? Units this small, this is as big as they should be, and they should get very much smaller. As that accurate, this is one for one kind of threat, radiological threats, but of course there's a whole constellation of these threats. What are the core enablers? And I will not suggest here that there's a short list, but one can begin to zero in, I think, on a few of them. That's certainly what I and some fellow investors started doing before 9/11 and have continued doing since. When Ithiel de Sola Poole wrote about what he called the technologies of freedom in 1983, he focused, of course, on the microcosm, the telecosm, bits, networks, and information. And we need those, of course, more than ever. A unit like this one can actually give you the radioactive signature, which, to my knowledge, no other unit in the world can do, certainly not in that size, actually tell you exactly what is hot. What is making your thing beep. It does that through very, very sophisticated spectral processing of the radiological fingerprint. Different, of course, heavy nuclei have different patterns. Experts can read these, but to pack that into something that size requires an enormous sophistication of processing power and databases and so on. And that's basically what enables that one. So you certainly need these traditional, I mean, we could never begin to think about the things we're thinking about now without the infrastructure of the telecosm and the processing power and the communications networks and so on. But they are only a starting point, because the terrorists do not kill you in the telecosm. You do not die in the digital world. You die in analog reality. That's where things go badly wrong. It's in the world of big, heavy stuff like you and me and atoms and things that go boom and poisons and so forth. And if you think schematically of the divide here, we have analog reality out there. We have to the far right our processors, our thinking, our communications networks, and in between we have systems that mediate and communicate between the two. We have sensors that pick up signals in the analog world and feed them into the digital world, and we have systems that move power and information, but particularly power in the other direction. And I want to talk really about what lies to the left of the telecosm and the microcosm, and they are surprisingly related to what lies to the right. Before you can read a chemical a biological or radiological fingerprint, you have to see something. I mean, most things don't announce their presence. Radiological materials happen to be quite cooperative in that regard. They come with their own power supply, their own light bulb. They keep sort of saying, here I am, you're dying, and so on. But anyway, so that is very helpful. But with most other threats, it's your job to light up the target. The target is doing its best not to announce its presence. And there's only one way to light things up. You have to project power outward. I mean, we know how to do that with light bulbs and so on. That's an old technology. But if you want to do this very accurately and very compactly, you have to project extremely precise, very compact, modulated power in just the right way, because some things respond to some wavelengths and some to others. Some wavelengths will excite DNA or destroy it. Some will excite the other biological proteins. Some see people, some see metal, some see large molecules, some see small molecules. One can go on down the list. A lifetime or two ago, Harold Edgerton, you know, the father of stroboscopic photography, was brought in by the Air Force to develop these gigantic magnesium flares that were loaded into the World War II bombers and dropped over nighttime Germany, and from 20,000 feet they would go boom, you know, and you could just flash, trigger your camera at that exact second, and you'd get a shot of the surface, and then you'd take off before they could shoot you down. The problem with these things is they were immensely hot. You were quite likely to burn down your plane, too. You were sure to if they went off early. It's very hard to generate a lot of radiation in the band where you want it without generating huge amounts of heat and junk, and it's very hard to project power accurately. Unfolding all around us today, and I'm only going to mention a few of them. This is a very rich field of development, but you'll see the acronyms and the shorthands for them. We have an enormous range of new technologies that project power outward across the entire electromagnetic spectrum, from the 1,000-kilometer length radio waves used to communicate with submarines to the millimeter waves in the 10 to 30 gig bands that provide radars of all sorts, and I'll mention a couple of those, to the submillimeter waves in the 30 to 90 gig bands that are being used more conventionally for satellite links, but also for seeing, in my sense of the word, up to the 1,000 micron scale waves in the 1,000 terahertz bands, the infrared bands, and on up. To pick one example again, this is a biological smoke alarm. It is it mounts up on a wall inconspicuously like a regular smoke alarm. It is deployed in the Pentagon today. It's in quite a number of classified government buildings in the United States and abroad. How do you make something this small that can tell you if there's a lot of biological protein floating in the air? Biological proteins are actually quite easy to light up. They fluoresce when illuminated with hard ultraviolet light. So if you have a really good mercury vapor lamp and you can, I don't know, I'm not even sure mercury vapor will get hard enough, but somewhere to the right of a mercury vapor lamp, you know, about this big, and if you break it, you have to call EPA and so on, you can light up biological proteins, but you can't mount it as a sniffer. Not long ago, a company, not the one I have some connection with, but another, managed finally to put a deep UV emitter on an LED. This is your alarm clock LED, or like the monitor I'm looking at here, except it does deep, hard UV. You don't want to hold it in your hand. It'll give you a terrible burn and probably cancer. But I mean, it is very good at lighting up biological proteins. And so if you incorporate that in an element like this, in just the right wavelength, you suddenly have a wonderful device that can sniff biological proteins. It will not give you the full signature of a PCR, a polymerase chain reaction analysis, but it'll tell you if a lot of stuff's floating in your air. And that's the first stage, and then you kick the sample on down to another compact a sensor. This is another light bulb, and I actually want to show you the products before I try and walk quickly through what I think are the core enabling technologies here. This is about the size of a coffee can. It's a millimeter wave radar, 360 degrees, kilometer ranges. It is protecting a number of quite a few high-value marine assets. It's very good for looking out over water and seeing if something's coming at you. You will recall that one of the pre-9/11 terror incidents involved precisely that, with the coal, the attack on a warship. This is a slightly bigger version of the same technology. This is from hundreds of meters to kilometers, another millimeter wave radar system. It is deployed widely around military bases in the United States and in Iraq, and it's been used for border control and for protecting villages in Israel and so on. It's a very compact, very portable, very low cost way of getting a wide area surveillance. So you can see crawlers, small things moving where they shouldn't be moving, toward you. Slightly larger units can give you ranges of several miles, which in with a single thing deployed at the top of a telephone post or some such will give you a multi-mile discernment, not of something the size of a battleship, that's useless, but because you're now in the millimeter wave bands, the short wavelengths, crawlers, small things that shouldn't be where they should be. A decade ago, you could not have built any of these things. They're simply, you could build big versions of them, you could not have built anything close to this small. You simply could not build the electrical circuits that would move the electrical currents back and forth fast enough to project power this efficiently, this compactly, over that wide range. The key to all of these and to much else has been the development, the evolution of high power semiconductors. If you were to track the history of switches in the telecosm, on this lower line, I'm sorry, the print's small, but it doesn't much matter. The voiceover will cover this. The triumph of the gate in microprocessors, in Pentiums, and so on, has been that every year or two, people make the gate smaller, smaller gates, packed more densely, less power, less power, less power, and these are all logarithmic scales. So you know, every 3 or 4 years, another factor of 10 reduction in the amount of power switched by the switch. And that's great, and semiconductors love that, because semiconductors don't really like to conduct electricity. So less power, they're always happier, okay? The problem is that Intel and other people keep packing more and more of them together, and so that has other problems. But basically, on a per-gate basis, they get happier and happier as they get smaller until you get other problems, you'd be in tunneling and so on. But for a long time, they've lowered and lowered the power switches, and we got better and better microprocessors and integrated circuits and so on. Well, that's very nice, but you don't, again, kill terrorists with microwatts. You kill terrorists with kilowatts. It's much harder to get kilowatts through semiconductors, but if you can adapt semiconductors to do high power, you can get the same compactness, I mean, very, very compact switching and control systems. You get all the efficiencies and declining cost curves of chip fabs, but you begin pushing things up the power curve. You begin pushing up to tens of watts, and then kilowatts, and then higher. This is an extreme example. It's a freak of nature, and I don't want to suggest it's typical, but it shows you what the outer limits of this process can be. This is a wafer. It's a silicon wafer made on a standard silicon fab. You don't have to look at all the devices. I don't know. There are about 50 on them. These are gate turn-off thyristors of a special architecture. Each one of these thyristors, standard silicon wafer, can actually handle on a pulse basis 8,000 volts and 25,000 amps. Now, if you can do that with semiconductor and with all the economies of a semiconductor line, you begin getting real control of lots of power. And with that kind of control, and there are many other devices, IGBTs and higher power MOSFETs and so on, and I've got some plots of a few of them. But once you begin doing that, you begin completely rethinking what you can do with radar and a whole range, and I'll get to some of them, of power projecting, power mediating technologies. And it is with power, of course, that you fight wars. These technologies have been actually developed and are used principally in the civilian sector. They are used in hybrid cars and industrial applications and in factories and for all sorts of applications, but they have tremendous promise and immediate application. In fact, the first application typically in the military and defense industries. At frequencies, metal antennas, of course, you can only push so high, and then you simply can't project radiation anymore. The wavelengths get too short. But when frequencies get too high and you begin moving up into the visible light and beyond, you then go to the direct semiconductor emitters. If you look again at the trends here, and all of these scales are logarithmic, in the past decade, and this is a continuing process, we've by no means reached the end of it, the new families of semiconductors, new chemical compounds, the wide bandgap semiconductors have pushed the direct emitters, the direct LEDs and the direct laser emitters to shorter and shorter wavelengths and higher powers. Getting flames and electrical wires and incendiary bombs to emit light isn't difficult, but it's very difficult to do it compactly in a small space. These things start small. They come off semiconductor lines. They are built with, they have all these economies of scale that are so familiar in this industry, and they continue to improve. These, if you want to look again at the trends, the first line, I mean, we all know what has happened to silicon wafers over time. They started small, they got bigger and bigger. That pushed the economies of scale. You look at the succeeding technologies, silicon carbide and gallium nitride and gallium arsenide and all the other, these are power semiconductors. They started much later. It is much harder to do power in a semiconductor, high power than low power, but they are now marching up the same kinds of steps. And some of these are just truly phenomenal compounds. Silicon carbide, for example, a very difficult material. Cree, the leading player in this. There are a few others. And it just does extraordinary things with power once you've got it. And once you really get control of your power, you begin building boxes like this. The absolute gold standard in a chemical lab, if you're handed something and you're asked, well, okay, what is this? What is this chemical? You put it in a mass spectrometer. A mass spectrometer, the principle is quite easy. You ionize your sample, you fire it down through a very strong electrical field, and you look at how much the bits and pieces of your sample swing in that field, and essentially you weigh the bits and pieces. You can get very exact chemical fingerprints. You can say what anything is in a mass spec. And it's been done for years and years, and all you need is a big desktop unit, and you can do it. But now they can put it in something the size of an Osborne computer, and it will be into a pager. I mean, it'll get there. It's good. That'll be another 5 or 10 years. What are the two enabling ingredients? First, very clever geometries, and then very clever mediation of your power and your electric fields, because this is essentially an electrophysical test of chemistry, and that's how these things get shrunk. I'll mention a few others, and I want to get to some deeper points in a moment. Infrared imaging. We are the most ubiquitous radiation, of course, is not visible radiation. It is in the infrared and lower bands. Our eyes can't see infrared. A pit viper can. It can see heat at night, but we can't. But again, we have seen the evolution of a whole constellation of new materials that have pushed up our ability to see, to sense infrared energy, all of them semiconductors or complex, closely related compounds that are pushing up the sensitivity of infrared sensors, so you get away from cooled cameras, which are very big and clunky because you've got to haul around a huge refrigerator with your tiny little imager, to smaller and smaller units that are now operating at room temperature. And we'll skip that one, we'll move right ahead. We are now moving the integrated visible light infrared cameras are shrinking down and down. There are different focal plane arrays that see in different bands. Sometime, probably about 15 years ago, our military began preferring to fight its wars at night. We are much better at night than fighting in the day. We can see everything at night. The enemy can't see anything, so that's when we try and fight. We love dust storms. We love all the invisibility conditions. I remember when they were first going into Afghanistan and people were saying, well, these guys can all hide in caves. If you are sitting in a cave, unless you are freezing to death, you have some thermal source in there, and you look at those caves at night, and they might have been shining a spotlight out of them saying, here I am, because any kind of heat was just radiating out of those mountains. And the colder it got and the darker it got, the brighter the entrances to the caves became. Some things are just very difficult indeed to light. It is impossible to light up protons and neutrons in atomic nuclei directly and thus measure atomic mass and determine chemical composition, but it is very difficult to light up a proton. Basically, there are only two ways, and one is to send X-rays at them and look at how the X-rays scatter, and the other is to use extremely powerful magnetic fields and look at how they oscillate. And people do this, of course, routinely. They do it badly and ineffectually in airports with these monster units that they've deployed, and they do it in medical applications, you know, where they can take these wonderful pictures with nuclear magnetic resonance and comparable technologies. But again, these are completely impractical and uneconomic for the kinds of challenges we faced. Very often, the best way to see a chemical is with another chemical. And this is where things really begin opening wide open. I can only mention some examples, but there is a tremendously fecund new body of chemistry that works something like this. A professor at MIT, Tim Swaggart, some years ago began working with chromophores. Now, chromophores are chemicals that fluoresce. You shine a light on them, and they shine back at you for a little while. It's standard fluorescence, pretty much. The MIT prof found a way to daisy chain chromophores into a polymer, so he had a polymer chromophore now. It was sort of like a string of Christmas tree lights, so you shine your LED stimulus on it and they shine back at you. And then he began packing onto them a series of binding molecules on top, very specific binding molecules, so you could build one for TATP, say. So a TATP molecule comes along, whonk, it gloms onto at some point on this long light of Christmas trees. And when one molecule went whomp, the whole chain turned off. It was like unscrewing one light bulb in the chain of Christmas tree lights, right, and they all go dark. So this gives you tremendous amplification right down at the molecular level. This particular unit is traveling around Iraq today. It is actually riding on a version of the iRobot called the PacBot, I think. It is sniffing and smelling. It is has been deployed in a number of other areas. This is about the only unit that I know of in the world that has been systematically tested, and is just about as good as a dog's nose. And a dog's nose is really good. But dogs are, you know, high maintenance employees. They require time off. They have benefits and the whole lot. I mean, it really gets quite difficult. This does not show the Fido on it, but this, some of you may know that gentleman. That's the PacBot, and instead of a camera at the top, it's riding around in a number of very bad places now with a Fido, just smelling explosives very specifically. What happens when you see and recognize something and you don't like it? Here we get way beyond the realms of the telecosm, because when you see something in this area, you don't sort of install parental controls. When you see something you don't like here, you have to kill it or destroy it, do something really nasty. Now, there are many old ways to kill things, and most of them are much like sort of Doc Edgerton's old magnesium flares. You burn everything in sight. You have wide area destruction. But those are not practical or acceptable ways, not for the kinds of threats we now face. They're, in fact, completely unacceptable. So the challenge, when you come to what the military, to coin a phrase, calls active denial, the challenge is to once again take power now, but to push it a step further up, to kill or destroy or deanimate very, very specifically, as specifically as you're sensing, so that you can give new meaning to the word surgical. You know, surgical used to mean you destroyed only an acre, or only, a large building. I mean, now you're talking surgical at the molecular, at the atomic level of destruction. And again, if you want to destroy or deanimate something very small, you have to be very, very precise in your projection of power. If you see anthrax, you want to jack up your UV light very specifically, right at the right place, and then you will chop up its DNA, and the anthrax will not hurt anybody. If your PacBot sniffs explosive in a barrel down the road, you want to dispatch a very focused beam, and these things are practical things; they're not theoretical of laser light. And then you blow it up remotely, and you don't destroy anything, but whatever that bomb was capable of destroying. Millimeter wave bands, if you pump millimeter waves up very precisely in very precise wave bands, and these are again now practical devices, you can cook things. You can zap people at distances of hundreds of meters and they feel like they've touched a hot light bulb, and if you turn it off fast enough, they just hurt and then they go away. They don't die. And so that's being quite actively pursued for crowd control and for perimeter securing without having to fire shells and artillery and so on. If you punch out 100 kilowatts of 95 gigahertz, you have an excellent kind of people distancing microwave oven. If you shift the frequency a bit and go for a longer pulse, you can of course do real damage. You can kill people. This is one I happen to have followed particularly closely. Solid-state lasers. So you can take a solid-state laser is a very small device. They read your disk drive and your computer. They're all over the place. I happen to have brought one with me here. I wonder if it works. Better point it the right way. This, I guess, is about 5 milliwatts. I'm shining there. Arrays of these are being commercially shipped to commercial customers and also shipped to other customers that in 48 kilowatt arrays of coherent light, continuous beam, that is 10 million times as bright as this light. And it's really quite spectacular to see what those things will do. And by the way, the arrays keep getting bigger, they keep getting more coherent, and they have tremendous power to sort of sanitize space around you and deanimate chemicals, to do remote sensing, and of course to detonate things far away. combine the two halves of this evolving world, the power semiconductors, which are not normally the subject of interest to people who talk about the telecosm and semiconductors and communications and bits, but the power side of that, with the other half, the intelligence, and you get, you get to this world, and this is just one schematic among many, where you start. You must always have a source of energy. You cannot project 48 kilowatts of continuous wave laser without having one hell of a power supply behind it. So you always need energy to start with. But the key is you begin controlling and shaping and defining what shape that energy will have with very complicated microprocessors. These are very complicated intelligent algorithms. You pack sensors around the system so you've got a continuous feedback for what's happening so you can tune it, you can choose your frequencies, your direction, your length of your pulse. I mean, you can basically shape power the way you'd paint a screen or do a Toy Story for Pixar, except that now you're sending out stuff that isn't just on a screen, that is really changing the world around you. And then you can drive motors, you can dispatch beams, you can dispatch millimeter waves, you can see, you can cook, you can fire, you can destroy. I mean, is that basic architecture? The number of civilian and industrial applications wildly eclipses today the number of military ones, but the leading edge of this has been pushed for the military and security applications. These basic architectures are found now in hybrid cars. You build a hybrid car around basically this architecture, all the electrical sides of it. They're being found in factory tools and in machine tools, and there's the Da Vinci surgical system. I mean, if you do keyhole surgery now, the best surgery, the surgeon doesn't touch you anymore. His hands are way too shaky. He has basically a system like this between his hands and your body, and the scalpel is being moved by servo motors and so on that take out the jitter and so on, and he's working on a screen. One can go on down the list, but above all, you put these technologies together, you can see anything, you can control it, you can destroy it if you have to. Let me transition to a couple of more abstract things with just one example. The sailing ship used to be very important, and I want to say a few words about that, but it was, of course, eclipsed quite some time ago by things that flew. The first century of flight, for the first century of flight, all of the leading edge in flight was toward bigger and more powerful. You went from a little flyer to a bigger, to a bigger, to a bigger. You increased the payload, you increased the wingspan. I mean, you just build up. And then suddenly, in the last 10 years, what happened? We have just all of the most exciting, interesting, important innovation in aviation is now toward the very small. I don't mean the business jet, folks. I mean the RPV kinds of things, all right? The unmanned Predator, which was so much in the news beginning 5 or 10 years ago and is still, what people think of when they think of a RPV is about the size of a pterodactyl, if you've seen one, a big bird, basically. Serious people, however, are now building bat-sized flyers. 6 inches across. Butterfly-sized RPVs are perfectly feasible now and being built as well. Some of the bird-sized flyers, of course, have ranges of miles, and they provide live color downlinks and are transmitting them back to wherever you like. The pilots, of course, are sitting miles away, basically playing an Xbox or something slightly more sophisticated. They are flying without being in the air at all. That turning of the corner, if I could change the labels on this and say computers, tracking it from 1950 to 1980 or 1975 and then suddenly turning the corner, we could do that with telecom systems and switches and so on. It's now being played out in the physical world, in the world of things that move things and project power and move weapons and move cameras, because these technologies, the technologies of controlling power in very compact spaces very precisely, has come of age. Quite a few people see a dystopian future here. They see these technologies, they see surveillance and projection of force and power, and they think of Orwellian vision, and there's perhaps some truth to that. Less, I think, than people suggest, but we live in times where one does have to watch for many things. But I see a much more different, a much more heartening and really fundamentally different trend, and that's this. Overwhelmingly today, the technologies of war now depend on the advance and the ubiquitous adoption of technology in the civilian sector. Of course, large defense contractors still assemble your Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, but the silicon, the communication systems, the power electronics, okay, are being propelled at least as much by their adoption in the civilian sector. The typical pattern here is something like this. If you looked, deconstructed your cell phone today and looked at some of the key power elements, you'd find a gallium arsenide chips in there, which are handling some of the power. Now, those chips were developed under military contract because the military knew it had to push up the frequency of its communication systems into the gigahertz bands, and nobody could do that in semiconductors not so long ago. And they sent out the contracts, gallium arsenide, and was very difficult to work with, and nobody thought it was particularly feasible, and they made it feasible, and now you've all got it in your phones. And that's the only reason the military can afford it, because it's gotten so cheap and so ubiquitous and so many of us are buying it that of course pushed everything down the power curves, and now of course it is incorporated in thousands and thousands of military and defense platforms. If you look at the sort of socioeconomic structure of our military defense systems, you look at where we invest our money today to protect ourselves, it looks more like it did in 1911 when Dwight Eisenhower entered West Point than it did in 1961 when Dwight Eisenhower gave his famous speech, a farewell address to the nation, warning us to beware the grave implications of the new military-industrial complex. It takes far, far fewer people today involved in the front lines of the war. That's familiar. But the military-industrial complex now, I oversimplify only a bit, is really just two bookends on this huge sort of civilian industrial complex. The military pushes technologies at the leading edge because they're the first adopters of the most difficult semiconductors, the highest frequency, the highest power. I mean, they can afford that. They need it the most. They push it the most. But they cannot afford to deploy it or to use it widely until it gets widely adopted in the civilian sector. They're pushing some of that leading edge. It gets widely adopted in cell phones, in hybrid cars, and in factories, and milling machines and heat treating systems, and then it moves back in the military to shoot and destroy and detect, but to do so ubiquitously and cheaply and in ways that just wouldn't be possible otherwise. The intelligent, methodical, precisely choreographed projection of power is the essence of war. It's the essence of security and defense. You do not defend yourself with bits. You defend yourself with force. In his 1985 classic, Guns, Sails, and Empires, the great economic historian Carlo Cipolla recounts how technology played the key role in the conquest and colonization from 1400 to 1700. Before, Europe had been weak and vulnerable, particularly to the Turks, to the Islamic world. And quite incapable of challenging distant empires like China, which were in many respects much more advanced on many technological fronts than Europe was. Then Europe mastered two key technologies, just two. Both technologies of power. The first was the technology of the cannon. Nobody else knew how to build cannons. The Europeans got them first. And the cannon, of course, allowed you to project terrifying power from a relatively safe distance. And then the Europeans mastered the technology of the big sailing ship, which could transport your cannons and effectively give your cannons a global reach. Cipolla writes the following. He says, exchanging oarsmen for sails and warriors for guns meant essentially the exchange of human energy for inanimate power. Europeans broke down the bottleneck inherent in the use of human energy and harnessed to their advantage far larger quantities of power. The one and unequivocal consequence of mastering gun and sail was a steadily growing European dominance worldwide. For the technologically laggard countries, Cipolla writes, things turned progressively for the worst. The historical advance of the technology of warfare can be collapsed onto a single chart, something like this one, and I just, hold on, we'll get, okay, let's back up now. I'm supposed to, oh shoot. All right. This time delay is very frustrating. Okay, stay there. If you track power or power density and speed, and you push technologies that can boost your power density, boost your absolute power, shrink the amount of space in which it moves, and accelerate how fast you can move it internally and as you move it outward, those are the two metrics of war. There are no others, okay? These are the key metrics at the first stage when you're projecting power to see your targets, find out what's out there, find out what it is you need to kill or destroy. That same principle holds for the delivery platforms, the missiles, the helicopters, the RPVs, the systems that move your fighting systems, your sensors, whatever it is you need to move out away from the areas you're trying to defend so you can move the carnage away from the people you're trying to protect. And it holds for the weapons, the lasers, the cruise missiles, the electromagnetic pulse generators, the armor-piercing projectiles, the guns, the explosives, the UV light, the microwave oven in a pocket, whatever it may be that you direct at your ultimate target. The more power you can pack into less space, the more precisely you can control it, and the faster you can control it, the more dominant you become in any conflict. However much we may dislike it, most of us know this is the truth. Wars like the one that came upon us 5 years ago are not going to be won, not in the conventional sense of the word. This war will continue in one form or another for as long as we live. Many pundits insist that technology won't win. You need troops on the ground, and of course you will always need troops somewhere. I mean, conflicts between people ultimately involve people. But I think that view that we need people gets things backward. We cannot begin to fight and protect ourselves with people. We simply do not have the same tolerance for shedding blood as the people who we are fighting. We are going to fight, I am quite confident, an endless succession of micro-scale battles. Military resources will be spread out across vast expanses of empty land and across urban hellholes and across our own cities, the richest, most affluent places on earth, and the poorest, most desolate ones. We will need these technologies in New York for obvious reasons, and we'll need them in the Hindu Kush, the poorest place on earth for obvious reasons, because the conflict we're engaging spans that great a distance. The technologies we have in hand today fundamentally change the calculus of war, most especially wars that in any other era would have been fought, would have become wars of extended slow motion human attrition, wars that inevitably favor the side most willing to dispatch young men and women into the line of fire. Until quite recently, the best infrared cameras were still the size of a coffee can, and they strained to detect the heat of the exhaust from a jet engine. Thimble-sized units now can detect the microscopic heat difference between the white stripe and the red stripe on an American flag at a distance of 2 miles. Sensors are now being built from the same materials as microprocessors in the same factories using the same core tools. Advanced radar will soon be far cheaper and more ubiquitous than binoculars and telescopes. Next generation radars will be built from arrays of single chip integrated transmitter receivers, which can be incorporated by the hundreds and the thousands into different platforms, weapon systems, munitions. Sensors are now being etched alongside memory, microprocessor, and transmitter on a single semiconductor chip. It is now feasible to build complete sensor modules with built-in low-power laser, flash memory, and CPU that are no larger than a grain of sand. It won't be long before we can manufacture them by the bucket and dust roadsides and hills and trails, and that is exactly what we will do. The cost is plummeting, as semiconductor costs always do, down tenfold in the last decade, down another tenfold in the next. Yesterday's military technologies grew larger and larger, more and more expensive, more and more distant from the people they had to protect. We are now engaged in exactly the opposite process towards smaller, cheaper, more ubiquitous. There is simply no other way to go. However advanced our power to destroy, and it is very advanced indeed, we obviously cannot bring down the other side's skyscrapers. They don't have any. This kind of enemy never will. So our longer-term objective must be to electronically infiltrate every corner of their homelands to the point where we can listen to and track anything that moves across enormous stretches of hostile territory, urban and rural, This will equip us to project destructive power selectively, precisely, judiciously, regretfully, from a safe distance, project it to many different places, again and again, week after week, year after year, for as long as that may be necessary to keep barbarity confined to the barren, impoverished places in which it currently hides. Properly deployed at home, these technologies of freedom will guarantee the physical security and our civil liberties too. Properly deployed abroad, they will destroy every last vestige of privacy and ability to hide in places that want to harm us. It seems anomalous to point to small-scale technologies as the answer to terrorists who brought down the two tallest skyscrapers in New York. But this is the technology that perfectly matches the enemy's character and strength. This technology can be replicated at very little cost. It is cheap and expendable. It is small. It can be highly mobile. It can be scattered far and wide across Manhattan, the richest place on earth, across Baghdad, across the Hindu Kush. It can infiltrate, image, track, and ultimately destroy the peasant soldier on the peasant soldier scale of things. It can win a war of attrition. Nothing else can. It is a horrible vision. I have said it before. It gives me no joy at all to say this, but I think there is. It would be irresponsible not to say it. This war will come down to a battle between their sons and our silicon, and our silicon will win. Thank you very much.
Time for questions, or yeah, here's a quick.
I would love to ask a question.
All right.
So it strikes me that you described a wonderfully broad spectrum of sensors and ability to project power, and neglected to talk about the one aspect of projecting power.
Stephen Sprague.
That we don't use effectively in today's prosecution of our war, which is our ability to project media. And we have our ability to project media today has become global. And we can use it in as a mechanism to influence before we end up with somebody who becomes a terrorist because they spent all day watching The Amazing Race or whatever. The most powerful weapon we have is media, and it's driven by the whole telecosm, and it's the least effective weapon that our military knows how to use.
You may well be.
State-sponsored media is very hard.
Repeat the question a little bit.
The general thrust of the question, if I understood it correctly, I think I did, is that we don't only have to project force and sense bad things. We can win hearts and minds in various ways. I was a big believer in that and still am when we were dealing with nation states. It's almost a cliche now, but it wasn't when George Gilder was writing this that, you know, the Soviet Union had this impossible internal conflict. They could either keep everybody ignorant and just fall further and further behind, or else they could harness, you know, steal our information technologies as best they could, in which case freedom would break out. China faces this same dilemma now, and I am enormously confident I don't think the military has to project to China. The Chinese will project to each other. I'd wish they'd do it faster, and they're being quite obnoxious about things, and, you know, Google has to make its own peace with them and so on. But be that as it may, I am less sanguine about that, to tell you the truth, though, when you're dealing with the people who operate at this very small scale of things. And in a way, the new media are actually quite congenial to them. Fortunately, they're not very smart about using them. They keep losing laptops and so on. But I hope you're right. Meanwhile, you know, you got to keep the powder dry.
Any other questions? Wait till.
Hi, my name is Steve. I just had a question about the seeming paradox of what you call this civilization complex. That wasn't quite right. It was the opposite of the military industrial complex. You had a different term for it. But it provided ubiquity of technology that the military then could, you know, widely deploy. it seems like the paradox in that is that ubiquity also gives our enemy the same access to the same technologies.
And that's that. And of course, I mean, we cannot forget that they used our technology to bring down the buildings, right? They didn't build those jets, we did. Then they didn't fuel them, we did. We fueled them too. The importance of the adoption, and it's a very cogent, important question you ask, which is how easily can all this stuff be turned against us. The importance of ubiquitous adoption is that it pushes down the cost curves. We have to see things everywhere, and you cannot do that on Pentagon procurement budgets. I'll tell you, one of the things that horrifies me about anthrax and the new vaccine problems is no part of the civilian sector will touch them. I mean, the anthrax vaccine is now, you know, there's one person in this country who can prescribe anthrax vaccine. Anybody know what it is? Yes, you've read my Forbes column. It's Donald Rumsfeld. He's got the authorization to say you're at risk and you can get it. Nobody else can. He's got the only contract to buy it. He's got the only FDA emergency use authorization. That's a very bad state of affairs because, you know, supposing he's out of town when, I mean, you know, it's you need this deep infrastructure of learning and physicians and so on, or else when things get bad, you know, the military is not good at making things ubiquitous. Now, can the other side use them? Yes, they have, up to a point. But in an arms race, you know, we are much better off at staying on the leading edge of this than trailers. I mean, the early adopters are our military, not their guys. Okay, they get the cell phones. They have a lot more trouble getting the Fidos and the iRobots. It's quite easy to take explosives and have no smell. I mean, you just got to stay squeaky clean, right? You wash everything off, you hermetically seal it. Nothing in the world can see it, short of a backscatter X-ray machine. But they don't know how to stay squeaky clean. You need labs for that. It's difficult to do, you know. And so I'm hopeful, but the question is a very worrisome one. How much of this can be turned around? Of course, a lot of this can be adapted mostly for sensing and seeing, and we don't mind if they see the radiation too. I mean, as long as we see it first. When you're talking about projecting power to destroy, it gets more complicated.
And everyone identify themselves when they ask a question. Nick?
Okay, I'm Nick Tredenick. We're not going to go and seed Afghanistan with sensors tomorrow. So could you give us kind of a timetable of what's
we're doing it
happen?
Today.
Well, not the kind you describe.
No, they're not as small. No, of course, they're never as small as you'd like. My laptop isn't as light as I'd like. I mean, they get better every year. Some of this actually know, and I know a lot of it from people who really know. I mean, how do you think we're watching Afghanistan today? You've got the spy satellites, you've got the predators, and you put this, I mean, look, I know I'm not giving away any classified information when I say you can put rocks beside every trail in Afghanistan and listen to measured footsteps and distinguish between, you know, a yak or whatever beast of burden they have and a walker, and that's exactly what we're doing. I mean, Israel, how do you think Israel is protecting themselves today? I mean, this fence we're going to build on our southern border is going to be a whole lot of it's going to be a virtual fence. It already is. It's not as good as it should be. It keeps getting better. The first ones were worse than useless, as I say. The time frame is today. I mean, the predators are flying today. The smaller ones are flying today. The sensors are very ubiquitous. If anybody's protecting you from radiation today, it is with these belt size units. I mean, that's what the Coast Guard's carrying when they board ships.
Ashby Foote, Peter, one of the shortcomings of an enemy like we face now that is a stateless enemy, which terror is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, for them to deploy an Air Force or a Navy. So almost all their action takes place, you know, on the ground somewhere. But if you look at our defense industry, or not defense industry, but the defense complex with the Pentagon, they have their own turf there where the Navy and the different services are all want their share of the budget. Are we going to be able to efficiently allocate resources so we can face this enemy that is almost, you know, 98% on the ground?
Look, I mean, asking for efficiency from the Pentagon is asking too much. But is the direction correct? Yes, it is. We've just passed the 3,000 dead mark in Iraq. Now, that each one of those was a real person, and that's tragic. With that said, I mean, and I don't want to be heard to say anything else, that is a minuscule number for a large war. I mean, you know, we've never had a serious war in history that was so tiny over such a long period of time. The biggest single problem we face in Iraq today is the IED, the improvised explosive device. We haven't done well the first 2 years, not as well as we'd like. We are getting better very fast. Okay, you got to sniff this stuff and you got to stand off till you blow it off. And there are, if I said you guys and the people you represent in this room have to build a better Nimitz class aircraft carrier, you might say, whoa, but if I say to you, look, I need better software, I need better semiconductors, I need better things that can control power and that can make sense of a spectral image and so on, you'd say, well, do you need it next week or next month? I mean, we have a several trillion dollar economy that is surrounded by people, packed with people who do this. This is a very close sibling to what people in this room do, and much of it is done by people in this room. The software infrastructure is there. The chip fabs are being used for this. I mean, the next generation's silicon carbide is much more difficult than silicon, but we know how to make very pure crystals. We've got really good crystal growers. I mean, crystals are ultimately crystals, and if you can do one, you're probably going to beat the next one too. So I'm basically optimistic about that, and I think the Pentagon, by and large, understands this. And people thought IBM would never be challenged, in 1965, but it was hard to be more efficient than IBM, but the smaller things did come along. I'm relatively optimistic about that. I wish it would go faster.
Good evening. My name is Mitin. You correctly identified